This is your daily news fix, the Daily Brief, right here on RCR.
Good afternoon, it's Friday, February 28th, and I'm Megan McNamara for RCR's Daily Brief. Jen Bainbridge is back today, delivering the latest headlines before the weekend. Next, we'll play clips from last night's episode of RCR 360 on trust in media, featuring interviews with LibNet's Andrew Lowenthal, interviewed by Alastair Harding, before Marie Buskey interviews internet law expert David Harvey. To wrap things up, we've got Natalie Cutler-Welsh and RCR Signpost. Now to the news.
Good afternoon, I'm Jen Bainbridge for RCR. Two complaints to the Law Society and one to police have been filed in response to a letter sent by law firm Franks Ogilvie. The letter is to 20 transgender healthcare providers warning them of potential legal action. It was to ensure all transgender healthcare providers aligned with the Ministry of Health's updated evidence brief and guidance. In a post on X, Franks Ogilvie director Stephen Franks said that the firm had been asked to write the letter because their client believes that some practitioners have their heads in the sand, refusing to acknowledge the now well-established absence of evidence of net benefit to justify the use of harmful drugs. Franks dismissed claims that the letter was intimidation and said that he did not expect the issue to go any further. The Health Select Committee has received nearly 15,000 written submissions on the gene technology bill, with the majority opposed. Approximately 900 people requested oral hearings, but only 400 substantive submissions have been selected. GE Free NZ says the number of submissions is significant, given they were gathered over the holiday period. Health Minister Simeon Brown is asking the Pharmacy Council for an explanation over its cultural competency standards. The guidelines require pharmacists to advocate for te tiriti at all levels, perform a waiata, and prioritise Māori voices. Many in the industry have called the standards absurd, woke, or racist. Overseas, US President Donald Trump has announced previously delayed plans to impose tariffs on Canada and Mexico will begin March 4th. The announcements unsettled the markets with fears of inflation and economic disruption. The tariffs include a 25% levy on most imports and a 10% tax on Canadian energy products. The 10% tariff on Chinese imports also doubles. Still overseas, US Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has paused a multi-million dollar contract with Vaxart Inc. for an oral COVID-19 vaccine. The 90-day stop work order halted clinical trials that had been set to begin on Monday with 10,000 participants. Meanwhile, the US Attorney General Pam Bondi has promised to release the long-awaited Epstein flight list today. The list belonged to the late Jeffrey Epstein and is speculated to contain names of prominent figures who travelled with him. Bondi says some information will be released, including flight logs and other records. And now for RCR Quick Links. Treasury fears government estimates for big projects are off ahead of Budget 2025. Opponents of a review of Internet NZ's constitution are planning a takeover, saying the not-for-profit is setting itself up as internet judge and jury. Foreign Minister Winston Peters is set to have talks on regional security and enhanced trade with South Korea when he visits the country later today. UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer is set to urge Donald Trump to back a US backstop for any Ukraine ceasefire, warning it's key to deterring Russia's Vladimir Putin. BlackRock and Bank of America have dropped their diversity policies, becoming the latest Wall Street giants to scrap the controversial initiative. And BP is expected to end its renewable energy target as part of a shift back towards fossil fuels. And that's RCR Bytes News for today, 28 February. I'm Jen Bainbridge.
If you missed RCR 360 last night, don't worry. We've got a few clips from the fascinating interviews featured on the show. Trust in media has been on a precipitous decline over the last few years, with no signs of that turning around. Part of what has led to the growing distrust, alongside the overt political bias exhibited, is the rise of the censorship industrial complex, a global web of state and non-state actors deeply invested in limiting what you can say online, and furthermore, selling that censorship to the public as a good thing. As a way to prevent people being misled by the twin threats of mis- and disinformation. How often do we hear those terms nowadays, when not that long ago, they were terms reserved for use by the intelligence community? In Alastair Harding's interview with Andrew Lowenthal, one of the journalists involved in exposing social media censorship via the Twitter files, they discuss who or what is behind this major effort to censor speech. Let's take a listen.
So when we talk about this, you mentioned early on in this conversation about a web. Is this a web which is coordinated? How is this all connected together? Is it a deliberate connection or is it just connections of convenience for all these different groups?
I mean, I think it's a lot of that is kind of speculation. I think there are more important nodes. So there are agencies or that give out more money than others, like the Global Engagement Center, which is under the State Department, like National Science Foundation, like HHS, like USAID, etc. So there are actors that are more important. There are particular people who are more important, of course, than others who are kind of making the funding, the decisions that this is going to be policy and this is what we're going to do. I mean, one of the things we know is that there was definitely a lot of White House pressure on Twitter and Facebook and other social media to censor content as well. So this stuff goes, you know, went right to the top of the government as well. Is there a kind of grand poobah person? There probably would be various candidates like Anthony Blinken or others, but I don't know that anyone's come up with enough evidence to say there's kind of one single entity. And I think in some ways it's not necessarily helpful way to think about it anyway, because there's just so much, like the scandal is that there's just so many agencies, so much private philanthropy, so much NGO and academic work that goes into this. It is a kind of massive kind of cultural phenomena. And that's the scandal is how did you convince so many people to essentially go along with this censorship work and think that they were doing something good. Like that for me is a scandal, not here's a secret bunker where, you know, the kind of chief censor is hiding.
Now let's hear a clip discussing how New Zealand is linked into this massive complex.
Our former Prime Minister, who took us through the COVID era, she derived a lot of her power during that time from the censorship industrial complex or the censorship apparatus. She's now traveling the world on the taxpayers' money as the head of what they call the Christchurch Call. And this she's basically calling for censorship. There was a famous speech she made to the UN talking about how words are weapons and so on. The fight here is over freedom of speech, isn't it? That's where it all comes down to. How important is this fight?
Well, I would actually go back to your first comment is that actually New Zealand is very important in this thing because of exactly what you said with the Christchurch call, that was a turning point, I think, where the kind of counterterrorism apparatus shifted quite significantly to countering violent extremism. And that was essentially in a shift from kind of external enemies. Obviously, the counterterrorism was also looking internally, but not at kind of vast swathes of the population. But the countering violent extremism basically said, "Oh, bad people could be anywhere, right? Because they look like the majority of or one half of the majority of the population in our societies." Right. And so we need to basically go and monitor and do more surveillance more broadly and generally and monitoring and censorship of hateful speech. And that I think at the end of the day, what this is a way for one group of people who are at the top of the pile or near the top of the pile, depending on in which society you're in, basically being able to like manage control the kind of frames of reference of the debate. Actually. And I'll give you an example of just how far that goes in another context with the UK. The chief of staff to Keir Starmer now, and a man by the name of Morgan McSweeney, was the founder of one of the leading so-called anti-hate or anti-disinformation organizations called the Center for Countering Digital Hate. So, and these were people who were trying to get RFK Jr. kicked off the internet during COVID. They had huge levels of access. They coordinated a letter that we found in the Twitter files of 12 Democratic governors, basically calling for this disinformation dozen, as they call them, to be taken off. The internet, they're very responsible for bringing down Jeremy Corbyn in the UK as well. And, you know, the guy who basically founded and ran that operation is now the chief of staff to the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom.
Let's now hear from Marie Buskey, an internet law expert and blogger, David Harvey. In this world of mass censorship and plummeting trust in the media, who are the bulwarks against power and government overreach?
In liberal democracies, the fourth estate used to be that check and balance against government in a liberal democracy. And it was that voice for the people if they saw things going awry. Well, that's now no longer the case. So is independent media like Substack, like ourselves here at RCR, are we now the new fourth estate that's not only check and balancing the government and those in power, but also having to check and balance legacy media?
I had a comment from a former journo on my Substack this morning saying, you know, where's Warwick Rodger? Where's Robin Langwell and the commentators of old? Well, you know, the answer to that is pretty much, except for a few journals like The Listener and North and South and so on and so forth, they're not there. So the mantle falls on the shoulders of citizen journalists, of which I classify myself as one. I have a fortnightly column in The Listener as well, so I'm under the Media Council's eye, Sauron's eye of the Media Council, chaired by my very good friend and former judge, Rainer Asher. But, so it's going the way of citizen journalists. And we are the ones who are going to have to hold government to account.
The full episode of RCR 360 is really worth a watch and can be easily found on our website or app. Now let's turn to Natalie Cutler-Welsh with the RCR Signpost.
Thanks, Megan. Hello, everyone. Happy Friday. Welcome to The Signpost. Natalie here, guiding you to RCR's best interviews, sharpest opinions, and real ways to take action. Did you catch last night's fascinating RCR 360, focusing on trust in media? Alistair Harding and Marie Buskey talked to Twitter Files insider Andrew Lowenthal and retired judge David Harvey around the growing distrust in mainstream media, exposing its bias, government influence, and lack of balanced reporting. I'm so looking forward to hearing your thoughts on that. Along a similar theme in the Fourth Estate, landing today, host Marty Gibson talks to Peter Williams and Annie O'Brien about legacy media's bias, government inaction on balanced reporting, and major shifts in the New Zealand Herald and Washington Post. While in the weekly roundup, Dewa De Boer and William McGimsey dive into the German elections, the potential reopening of Marsden, and law and order in New Zealand. There's plenty more to catch up on, like Paul Brennan's recent chat with Dr. Naomi Wolf, exploring USAID, DOGE, and the risks of Elon Musk's access to government data. In Media Matters, Marie Buskey and Marty Gibson tackle New Zealand's education and economic challenges, while Lindsay Perigo outlines why he's withdrawing his support from Orange Man Badass in Perigo's perspective. And there's a dragon boat on the horizon in Kiwi Farm. And this Sunday at 8 p.m., there's another opportunity to connect in with the RCR family. Join us for Wally Richards' Winter Gardening Webinar. You can join Rodney Hyde and our gardening guru, Wally, for expert tips and tricks and get your questions answered. You can check the show notes for the registration link to join that conversation. I will be emceeing the webinar, so I'll see you there. If you need a hand navigating the new RCR website and app, we've got you covered. You can just tap on your profile picture in the top right corner and select Help Center. There you'll find webinar recordings walking you through the key features, tips on making the most of RCR 2.0, and even a direct link to our tech team if you need extra support. Dive in and get the most out of your RCR experience. Have an amazing weekend, everyone. I hope to see you on Sunday at 8 p.m. Back to you, Megan.
And that wraps up the Daily Brief for this week. We hope you enjoyed all the insightful news and commentary, and we'll be back next week with more. Of course, the links to all of today's interviews can be found below. We hope you have a fantastic weekend, catching those late summer vibes, and we'll be here on Monday for another edition of the Daily Brief. Until then, see ya!